Please, senor. Not me. Take her. Take my daughter. Jacob looked up at her, away from the child's feet, his mouth still open with laughter, and was struck by the terror in her eyes. His laugh creaking to a close, he shook his head, thinking, God help me, if this is not the most wretched business.
Welcome back to Book Tour and the second part of Toni Morrison's reading from her new novel, A Mercy. As we continue, the tradesman Jacob Vark has journeyed to a Maryland plantation and is about to join the owner, D'Ortega, for dinner.
Footfalls, loud and aggressive, were followed by D'Ortega's call. Well timed. Come, Jacob, come. He motioned toward a parlor. Good day, sir. Thank you, sir, said Jacob, marveling at his host's coat, his stockings, his fanciful wig, elaborate and binding as those trappings must be in the heat. D'Ortega's skin was as dry as parchment, while Jacob continued to perspire. The condition of the handkerchief he pulled from his pocket embarrassed him as much as his need for it. Seated at a small table, surrounded by graven idols, the windows closed to the boiling air, he drank sassafras beer and agreed with his host about the weather and dismissed his apologies for making him endure it to come all this way. That said, D'Ortega swiftly got to business. Disaster had struck. Jacob had heard about it, but listened politely with a touch of compassion to the version this here client debtor recounted. D'Ortega's ship had been anchored a nautical mile from shore for a month, waiting for a vessel due any day to replenish what he had lost. A third of his cargo had died of ship fever. Fined 5,000 pounds of tobacco by the Lord Proprietary's magistrate for throwing their bodies too close to the bay, forced to scoop up the corpses, those they could find. They used pikes and nets, D'Ortega said, a purchase which itself cost £2.6, and ordered to burn or bury them. He'd had to pile them in 2 drays, 6 shillings, cart them out to lowland where salt weed and alligators would finish the work. Does he cut his losses and let his ship sail on to Barbados? No, thought Jacob. A sloven man, stubborn in his wrongheadedness, like all of the Roman faith, he waits in port for another month for a phantom ship from Lisbon, carrying enough cargo to replenish the heads he has lost. While waiting to fill his ship's hold to capacity, it sinks, and he has lost not only the vessel, not only the original third, but all, except the crew, who were unchained, of course, and 4 unsaleable Angolans, red-eyed with anger. Now he wanted more credit and 6 additional months to pay what he had borrowed. Dinner was a tedious affair, made intolerable by the awkwardness Jacob felt. His rough clothes were in stark contrast to embroidered silk and lace collar. His normally deft fingers turned clumsy with the tableware. There was even a trace of raccoon blood on his hands. Seeded resentment now bloomed. Why such a show on a sleepy afternoon for a single guest well below their station? Intentional, he decided. A stage performance to humiliate him into a groveling acceptance of D'Ortega's wishes. The meal began with a prayer, whispered in a language he could not decipher, and a slow signing of the cross before and after. In spite of his dirty hands and sweat-limp hair, Jacob pressed down his annoyance and chose to focus on the food. But his considerable hunger shrank when presented with the heavily seasoned dishes. Everything except pickles and radishes was fried or overcooked. The wine, watered and too sweet for his taste, disappointed him, and the company got worse. The sons were silent as tombs. D'Ortega's wife was a chattering magpie, asking pointless questions. How do you manage living in snow? And making sense-defying observations, as though her political judgment were equal to a man's. They had 6 children, 2 of whom were old enough to sit at table, stone-quiet boys, 13 and 14, wearing periwigs like their father, as though they were at a ball or a court of law. His bitterness, Jacob understood, was unworthy, the result of having himself no survivors, male or otherwise. Now that his daughter, Patrician, had followed her dead brothers, there was no one yet to reap the modest but respectable inheritance he hoped to accumulate. Thus, tamping envy, as taught in the poorhouse, Jacob entertained himself by conjuring up flaws in the couple's marriage. They seemed well suited to each other, vain, voluptuous, prouder of their pewter and porcelain than of their sons. It was abundantly clear why D'Ortega was in serious debt, turning profit into useless baubles, unembarrassed by sumptuary, silk stockings, and an overdressed wife, wasting candles in midday. He would always be unable to ride out any setback, whether it be lost ship or ruined crop. Watching the couple, Jacob noticed that husband and wife never looked at each other, except for a stolen glance when the other looked elsewhere. He could not tell what was in those surreptitious peaks, but it amused him to divine the worst while he endured the foolish, incomprehensible talk and inedible dishes. They did not smile, they sneered, did not laugh, giggled. He imagined them vicious with servants and obsequious to priests. His initial embarrassment about the unavoidable consequences of his long journey, muddy boots, soiled hands, perspiration and its odor, was dimmed by Mistress D'Ortega's loud perfume and heavily powdered face. The only, if minor, relief came from the clove-smelling woman who brought the food. His own Rebecca seemed ever more valuable to him the rare times he was in the company of these rich men's wives, women who changed frocks every day and dressed their servants in sacking. From the moment he saw his bride-to-be struggling down the gangplank with bedding, 2 boxes, and a heavy satchel, he knew his good fortune. He had been willing to accept a bag of bones or an ugly maiden, in fact, expected one, since a pretty one would have had several local opportunities to wed. But the young woman who answered his shout in the crowd was plump, comely, and capable, worth every day of the long search made necessary because taking over the patroonship required a wife, and because he wanted a certain kind of mate, an unchurched woman of childbearing age, obedient but not groveling, literate but not proud, independent but nurturing, and he would accept no scold. Just as the first mate's report described her, Rebecca was ideal. There was not a shrewish bone in her body. She never raised her voice in anger, saw to his needs, made the tenderest dumplings, took to chores in a land completely strange to her, with enthusiasm and invention, cheerful as a bluebird. Or used to be. 3 dead infants in a row, followed by the accidental death of Patrician, their 5-year-old, had unleavened her. A kind of invisible ash had settled over her, which vigils at the small graves in the meadow did nothing to wipe away. Yet she neither complained nor shirked. her duties. If anything, she threw herself more vigorously into the farm work. And when he traveled, as now, on business, trading, collecting, lending, he had no doubts about how his home was being managed. Rebecca and her two helpers were as reliable as sunrise and strong as posts. Besides, time and health were on their side. He was confident she would bear more children, and at least one, a boy, would live to thrive. Dessert, applesauce and pecans, was an improvement, and when he accompanied D'Ortega on the impossible-to-refuse tour of the place, his mood had lifted slightly, enough to admire the estate honestly. The mist had cleared, and he was able to see in detail the workmanship and care of the tobacco sheds, wagons, row after row of barrels, orderly and nicely kept, the well-made meat house, milk house, laundry, cookhouse, all but the last, whitewashed plaster, a jot smaller than the slave quarters, but unlike them, in excellent repair. The subject, the purpose of the meeting, had not been approached. D'Ortega had described with attention to minute detail the accidents beyond his control that made him unable to pay what he owed. But how Jacob would be reimbursed had not been broached. Examining the spotted, bug-ridden leaves of tobacco, it became clear what D'Ortega had left to offer. Slaves. Jacob refused. His farm was modest. His trade needed only himself. Besides having no place to put them, there was nothing to occupy them. Ridiculous, said D'Ortega. You sell them. Do you know the prices they garner? Jacob winced. Flesh was not his commodity. Still, at his host's insistence, he trailed him to the little sheds where D'Ortega interrupted their half-day's rest and ordered some 2 dozen or more to assemble in a straight line, including the boy who had watered Regina. The two men walked the row, inspecting, D'Ortega identifying talents, weaknesses, and possibilities, but silent about the scars, the wounds, like misplaced veins tracing their skin. One even had the facial brand required by local law when a slave assaulted a white man a second time. The women's eyes looked shockproof, gazing beyond place and time, as though they were not actually there. The men looked at the ground, except every now and then, when possible, when they thought they were not being evaluated. Jacob could see their quick glances, sideways, wary, but most of all, judging the men who judged them. Suddenly, Jacob felt his stomach seize. The tobacco odor, so welcoming when he arrived, now nauseated him. Or was it the sugared rice, the hog cuts, fried and dripping with molasses, the cocoa Lady D'Ortega was giddy about? Whatever it was, he couldn't stay there surrounded by a passel of slaves whose silence made him imagine an avalanche seen from a great distance. No sound, just the knowledge of a roar he could not hear. He begged off, saying the proposal was not acceptable, too much trouble to transport, manage, auction. His solitary, unencumbered proficiency was what he liked about trade. Specie, bills of credit, quit claims were portable. One satchel carried all he needed. They walked back toward the house and through the side gate in the ornate fence, D'Ortega pontificating all the while. He would do the selling. Pounds? Spanish sovereigns? He would arrange transportation. Hire the handler. Stomach turning, nostrils assailed, Jacob grew angry. This is a calamity, he thought. Unresolved, it would lead to years in a lawsuit in a province ruled by the king's judges, disinclined to favor a distant tradesman over a local Catholic gentleman. The loss, while not unmanageable, struck him as unforgivable. Barely listening to D'Ortega's patter, sly, indirect, instead of straight and manly, Jacob neared the cookhouse and saw a woman standing in the doorway with two children, one on her hip, one hiding behind her skirts. She looked healthy enough, better fed than the others. On a whim, mostly to silence him and fairly sure D'Ortega would refuse, he said, "Her, that one. I'll take her." D'Ortega stopped short, a startled look on his face. "Oh, no, impossible. My wife won't allow. She can't live without her. She is our main cook, the best one." Jacob drew closer, and recognizing the clove-laced sweat, suspected there was more than cooking D'Ortega stood to lose. "You said any. I could choose any. If your word is worthless, there's only the law." D'Ortega lifted an eyebrow, just one, as though on its curve an empire rested. Jacob knew he was struggling with this impertinent threat from an inferior, but he must have thought better of returning the insult with another. He desperately wanted this business over quickly, and he wanted his way. "Well, yes," said D'Ortega, "but there are other women here. More, you see them. Also, this one is nursing." "Then the law it is," said Jacob. D'Ortega smiled. A lawsuit would certainly be decided in his favor, and the time wasted in pursuing it would be to his advantage. "You astound me," he said. Jacob refused to back down. "Perhaps another lender would be more to your liking," he said, and enjoyed seeing the nostril flare that meant he had struck home. D'Ortega was notorious for unpaid debts and had to search far outside Maryland for a broker, since he had exhausted his friends and local lenders refused what they knew would be inevitable default. The air tightened. "You don't seem to comprehend my offer. I'm not forfeiting my debt. I'm honoring it. The value of a seasoned slave is beyond adequate. Not if I can't use her. Use her? Sell her. My trade is goods and gold, sir," said Jacob Vark, landowner. And he could not resist adding, "But I understand how hard it is for a papist to accommodate certain kinds of restraint." "Too subtle?" wondered Jacob. "Not at all, apparently," for D'Ortega's hand moved to his hip. Jacob's eyes followed the movement as the ringed fingers curled around a scabbard. Would he? Would this curdled, arrogant fop really assault his creditor, murder him, and claiming self-defense prerogative, rid himself of both debt and social insult, even though it would mean complete financial disaster, considering that his coffers were as empty as his scabbard? The soft fingers fumbled for the absent haft. Jacob raised his eyes to D'Ortega's, noticing the cowardice of unarmed gentry confronted with a commoner. Out here, in wilderness dependent on paid guards, nowhere in sight this Sunday, he felt like laughing. Where else but in this disorganized world would such an encounter be possible? Where else could rank tremble before courage? Jacob turned away, letting his exposed, unarmed back convey his scorn. It was a curious moment. Along with his contempt, he felt a wave of exhilaration, potent, steady, an inside shift from careful negotiator to the raw boy that once prowled the lanes of town and country. He did not even try to mute his chuckling as he passed the cookhouse and glanced again at the woman standing in its door. Just then, the little girl stepped from behind the mother. On her feet was a pair of way too big woman's shoes. Perhaps it was that feeling of license, a newly recovered recklessness, along with the sight of those little legs rising like two bramble sticks from the bashed and broken shoes, that made him laugh. A loud, chest-heaving laugh at the comedy, the hopeless irritation of the visit. His laughter had not subsided when the woman, cradling the small boy on her hip, came forward. Her voice was barely above a whisper, but there was no mistaking its urgency. "Please, senor, not me. Take her. Take my daughter." Jacob looked up at her, away from the child's feet, his mouth still open with laughter, and was struck by the terror in her eyes. His laugh creaking to a close, he shook his head, thinking, "God help me, if this is not the most wretched business." "Why, yes, of course," said D'Ortega, shaking off his earlier embarrassment and trying to reestablish his dignity. "I'll send her to you immediately." His eyes widened, as did his condescending smile, though he still seemed highly agitated. "My answer's firm," said Jacob, thinking, "I've got to get away from this substitute for a man." But thinking also, perhaps Rebecca would welcome a child around the place. This one here, swimming in horrible shoes, appeared to be about the same age as Patrician, and if she got kicked in the head by a mare, the loss would not rock Rebecca so. "There is a priest here," D'Ortega went on. "He can bring her to you. I'll have them board a sloop to any port on the coast you desire." "No," I said, "no." Suddenly, the woman smelling of cloves knelt and closed her eyes. They wrote new papers, agreeing that the girl was worth 20 pieces of 8, considering the number of years ahead of her, and reducing the balance by 3 hogsheads of tobacco, or 15 English pounds, the latter preferred. The tension lifted, visibly so, on D'Ortega's face. Eager to get away and re-nourish his good opinion of himself, Jacob said abrupt goodbyes to Mr. D'Ortega, the two boys, and their father. On his way to the narrow track, he turned Regina around, waved at the couple, and once again, in spite of himself, envied the house, the gate, the fence. For the first time, he had not tricked, not flattered, not manipulated, but gone head to head with rich gentry, and realized, not for the first time, that only things, not bloodlines or character, separated them. So, mightn't it be nice to have such a fence, to enclose the headstones in his own meadow? And one day, not too far away, to build a house that size on his own property, on that rise in back, with a better prospect of the hills and the valley between them. Not as ornate as D'Ortega's, none of that pagan excess, of course, but fair and pure, noble even, because it would not be compromised, as Jublia was. Access to a fleet of free labor made D'Ortega's leisurely life possible. Without a shipload of enslaved Angolans, he would not be merely in debt. He would be eating from his palm instead of porcelain, and sleeping in the bush of Africa rather than a 4-post bed. Jacob sneered at wealth dependent on a captured workforce that required more force to maintain. Thin as they were, the dregs of his kind of Protestantism recoiled at whips, chains, and armed overseers. He was determined to prove that his own industry could amass the fortune, the station, D'Ortega claimed, without trading, his conscience for coin.
In the third part of Toni Morrison's reading from her new novel, A Mercy, we'll follow Jacob Vark as he journeys home. Join us at npr.org/booktour.